Welcome back to the FKT podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Today we're chatting with Greg Nance, who has over 40 FKTs on the site. Join us to learn more about establishing new routes around the world, running from sea level to 14,000 feet, and his upcoming project, the Salmon Runs for Youth Mental Health in partnership with the Nisqually Tribe. Greg, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I'm really happy to chat with you about some of these FKTs you've done.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Heather.
Recently, you established two FKTs along the Caribbean. One is the Cuba Traverse, and the other was the Cartagena Caribbean Coast in Colombia. And so I would love to know why you chose these routes, what goes into establishing a brand new FKT, how you picked them, and how you developed them.
Yeah, so for me, I love running as a means to explore, to go see more of the world. I have always wanted to go to both places, to Cuba and to Colombia. And then now that I'm a member of the FKT community, one of the first things I asked is, huh, what would be a cool run? No one had set a Cuban time, so I realized, hey, it's up to me to put one on the board here. I recently ran from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean in the United States. And I was saying, hey, what if I did something similar in Cuba, running from the Caribbean to the Gulf of Mexico? And after setting that little goal, it was a matter of what would be a cool way to do this, because there's a bunch of coastline and I researched there's two really scenic bays. It's relatively close. And then there's going to be a lot of different climates, a lot of different kinds of roads, neighborhoods, people to do that. So part of it for me, it's a sense of adventure and exploration. And then a little bit of fun research projects. I don't actually know anyone in Cuba before this trip. So a lot of that is really trying to rack your brain, figure out what's a good way to do it.
That's awesome. So can you tell us a little bit about what each of these routes ended up being like once you got out there and did them, like road, trail? Was it what you expected?
It was not what I expected. And I went in without any clear expectations, but it ended up being a sunrise start with a foot in the Gulf of Mexico. I got a ride to this beach. It's called Cahia Beach in the south of Cuba, from a wonderful Cuban half marathon runner named Ariel, who I had met through a new friend. He takes off work to drive me to the south of the country. Wow. High fives at the start line. And this was once some kind of resort by the look of it, but nature had basically taken its course, where I think a storm surge during hurricanes and things had kind of knocked it out. And then the jungle had reclaimed a lot of this former resort. And so it was a little eerie and spooky, but it was also so beautiful that we're here. I'm here with a new buddy. High five. Let's roll. And it was remarkable because within a mile or two of the beach, it feels like a land that time has forgotten. And it's farmers with sickles. It's fellows riding very old bicycles, smoking long cigars. And you have these sort of plantation style farms where huge plantations that I'm passing by, and the roads are not super well maintained, but it created a very rustic experience. And some of the kindest, sweetest villagers and townspeople as you're passing through. And one of the things as an American that really struck me was there's all of these murals to the La Revolucion and to Fidel and to these other cast of characters, and telling them to retain the patriotism for the revolution. And got a little bit of a kick out of that, traversing the country and just meeting all these great folks paired with these iconic billboards all throughout as well.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I imagine that's quite the cultural experience.
Yes, totally. Yeah, I'd never been, so eyes wide open for sure.
Right. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the route that you did in Colombia, the route itself, and also any cultural observations you had from that as well?
Yeah. So likewise, I'd never actually been to Colombia, though it's been a place on my list. I go with my family. We head to Cartagena, which is a really magnificent city on the Caribbean. And since its founding in the mid 16th century, it has really been the beating heart of commerce to get all of these minerals, all of these valuable commodities from the interior of Colombia out to the coast to ship it to the world, including gold and silver and sugar and cocoa and all kinds of things. So a lot of cultural heritage baked in. My first impression, there are so many old, glorious buildings that have been here hundreds and hundreds of years. And this was really the most strategic point in the Southern Caribbean for the Spanish Empire, which was administering the place for quite a time. So those footprints, those fingerprints, are everywhere. And no matter where you go in Cartagena, you're getting a sense of that. This run was all about connecting the entire Caribbean coast of Cartagena. So there's a far southwest where you run out of land and you're at the end of a long peninsula. So start with a foot in the Caribbean there and then hightail it heading northeast along this big kind of shoreline. Some of it's white sandy beach, some of it's promenade style, like old brick that's laid out. Hmm. And you pass these glorious fortifications that were used to repel pirates over the last hundreds of years. Imagine huge cannons that they would fire off at the pirates to try to keep them away. And you're running right underneath that and just, wow, like, this is too cool. I ended up being somewhere around half a marathon, around 12, 13 miles, I think. And I was running as hard as I could and not the best terrain. So I had my trail runners on. And again, really cool people who were just like, who is this guy? I was running after dark to keep the heat down. And then a lot of the city's built right on top of the ocean. And so the Caribbean is coming in. I got hit with three or four sprays from the wave. So it is a cool route for those that like some fun off the beaten path adventure, cultural heritage, and maybe a splash of salt water as well.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was wondering if the tide played a role in like the timing of when you ran that since you were right on the ocean.
Luckily, I picked after sunset when the legs were feeling good. And so didn't play a big role. I'm sure, though, at lower tides, there's more beach to run, higher tides, less beach, but didn't even notice. I was just off to the races.
So. Right. You briefly mentioned the weather. I would imagine both Cuba and Colombia are both quite hot and humid. And I don't know where you live, but I'm guessing it's not as hot and humid as there. So I was wondering if you could speak to the weather, how it affected you, or if you did any sort of training or acclimatization in advance.
That, Heather, that would have been a good idea. So I live in Seattle, so definitely not as hot as Cuba or Colombia. And I did the Cuban Traverse, I think it was January 2nd of 2023, and then did this Colombian run 5 weeks later. So in neither case was I properly acclimatized to the heat or to the humidity. Actually gets me worse. So it really dehydrates you and it really takes away the pace because my heart rate accelerates and then gets into kind of unhealthy ranges, I think, for a multi-hour effort. So that would have been a good idea to train it hard. But those thinking about it, play the sun. During the heat of the day, it can actually be dangerous, especially if you're out unsupported in the middle of nowhere. So yeah, be prudent. Try to train up if you can before tropic efforts.
Right. I can't remember, were you supported on these? Did you have somebody helping you out?
For Cuba, I was supported. So my buddy Ariel, who I mentioned, he actually filled up a little ice chest, had beverages for me, and also saved my bacon because the villages in Cuba are few and far between on this route, at least. And I would have gotten myself into trouble because it was pushing 100 degree plus on the pavement. And I was totally untrained for that. In Colombia, it was a solo unsupported effort. And luckily it was about a half marathon distance. So that felt totally reasonable. I had water in my rucksack and just got after it. And then I had a nice Powerade equivalent at the finish line. So that wasn't too bad.
You weren't just buying coconuts along the way and drinking the coconut water?
I should have. When I go back to beat the time, that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, I spent some time in Hawaii on Maui once, and that was my thing. I would run on the beach in the morning, and then I would always swing through the fruit stand on the way home and be like, yes, coconut, please, and
boom,
drink the coconut.
Yeah. Living life right there, yes.
Yeah, it was awesome. I used to live in Seattle as well, and I remember when I went to run her in Hawaii, and sitting in the sauna is not exactly the same as training in humidity, but it ended up being enough. But I'm always curious when I see tropical FKTs or tropical efforts from people who are most definitely not living in the tropics. And I'm just like,
oh man,
how was it?
And you're on the right track with the sauna piece. I do calisthenics, knock out some push-ups or do some flexibility work to try to boost the heart rate a bit and then work at just body adapting. And you're also right. That's not the full game. Like you got to put in some miles in that too. And that's tough when you're in Seattle.
Yeah. So was there anything else you'd like to add about either of these routes that I didn't touch on?
Yeah, just an encouragement to the community. So I know a lot of folks like to travel. And even if there's not a route in the place you're going, use that actually as a chance to go set a route. And part of the standards, it has to be notable enough where someone else would want to do it, right? And it should be obvious enough where someone else can figure it out using your GPX. And so use that as an encouragement because when you zoom out on the FKT map of the world, there's still a lot of places that are way undercovered. Like Cuba is a special place. There's an incredible community of runners in Cuba. My buddy Ariel now is helping to spread the word. And my hope is that we'll have a couple dozen FKT routes in place that deserves more FKT coverage. And so every one of us, everyone listening, we all together can actually help to build a more global perspective for fastest known time. And that would be, I think, a wonderful outcome of all this is that every one of us can contribute.
Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. So I'd like to switch gears to something completely different that you did last year, last August. And if I'm not wrong, I believe you were the first person to do this. Other people have done a sea to summit on Mount Rainier, but they've usually biked and then climbed. And I believe you're the first person to do it all on foot. Is that correct?
That, as far as I know, yep.
Okay.
All on foot.
I am very curious what inspired you to do that instead of doing the bike climb combo that everybody else has always done.
Yeah. So number one, I grew up on Bainbridge Island. And so from the time I can remember, I've looked out on the horizon and there is Mount Rainier, Tahoma. And it's hard to describe for folks who haven't actually seen it just how incredible and majestic this mountain is. So since the time I can remember, I've looked up at the mountain and be like, I'm going to climb that. And for the last several years, I have been climbing it. And I feel so at one with the universe. And it's like, it's a spiritual experience for me getting up there. And as I've gotten more and more into running, I realized, hey, wouldn't that be cool to run from the Puget Sound, an inlet of the Pacific at sea level, all the way to the top? And I've done a little bit of historical digging. I realized, wow, look, people have biked this from the Sound up to a Paradise, which is the final parking lot, where you then begin climbing a little over 5,000 feet for 9,000 plus net elevation gain. I realized, hey, this all told would be about 85, 86 miles. I've run more than 85, 86 miles. Maybe I could actually do this. And I had just finished the run across America. And in finishing, I had pretty strong fitness. I had been doing 40 plus miles every day. And I thought, wow, I'm never going to be this fit again and have this much bandwidth before kind of going back to work again. So let's do it. And it was, I think, 17-ish days after I had finished the run across America. We have a perfect forecast where I had never seen this before. It was forecasted to be 0 mile per hour winds on top with 100% visibility. And wow. I've been up on Rainier every summer since I was probably 13 or 14. And I've never seen that forecast. And it was forecasted to be about 35 to 40 degrees. So above freezing up top. And I said, hey, look, this is an omen from the universe. Like, I got to go for it. And I roped in two really good friends, Savannah and Andrew, that helped crew me. And we had this run like clockwork, and the 86 miles just flowed by as we're slowly but surely climbing. And I get to Paradise, switch out my rucksack for my climbing ruck, and head up to solo the peak. And it was a really, really just special experience getting up there with ideal conditions, commemorating this, you know, wonderful adventure.
I know that there used to be a foot race in Bellingham that ran from Bellingham Bay to the summit of Mount Baker, because I have a friend, Dan Probst, who's been trying to revive that, because it was like a big thing like at the turn of the last century to do this run. But yeah, I'm not aware of anybody that ever ran up Rainier. So I think that's pretty cool. Had you soloed Rainier before? Because you soloed it during this effort. Had you soloed it before? Obviously, you'd been up there many times.
I have, and I grew up in the Cascade Mountains. So yeah, mom and dad would take us out from the time I can remember. So I was a mountaineer before I was a runner. And I love putting the two together because it's, you can see even more of the mountain when you're off hustling around running. So yeah, it was a glorious day, truly.
Yeah. I mean, the Northwest is the perfect place to marry those two.
100%.
Yeah. Since it was a supported FKT, why did you choose to do the mountain unsupported rather than having crew come up there with you to help you with gear and food and whatever?
Yeah. So two of my good buddies are big time climbers. One of them has been up Everest 10 times. And initially, I wanted to connect schedules where I could do it with one of these guys. They were off guiding. They're off in the Himalaya in one case, I think Tibetan Highlands in the other. And so I realized, hey, a couple of the climbers that I would feel safest with are actually not around. And then I got to a place where a few of the folks that I was, you know, thinking about, they're a little less experienced. And my goal was, hey, I don't want to create a situation where I'm putting them through a situation where they're not as comfortable. And so I've been up high enough by myself to be really just dialed. And so we're going to keep it simple. I'm just going to go up given the pristine conditions we have. And that way I don't have to wrangle a friend out of work or out of looking after their little ones.
And what was the running route, the approach to Rainier to Paradise? Did you run the same way that people typically ride their bikes, or did you come up with a different route that was more maybe appropriate for running?
Yeah, so there's a special connection here. So I began at the Billy Frank Jr. National Wildlife Preserve, which is this absolutely extraordinary protected wilderness at the Delta, where the Nisqually River meets the Puget Sound. Absolutely beautiful. And it's one of my favorite places on the planet. So I began there, and then I followed the Nisqually watershed basically all the way up to the glacier. And the glacier is even higher than Paradise. So that's what you start climbing on to get to Camp Muir, and then to head even higher toward the summit. And so that glacier, its melt is what formed the Nisqually River, and that has fed the Nisqually people, one of our proud native tribes here in Washington, since time immemorial. And I've come to know and really, really deeply admire and respect a number of Nisqually and how they've worked to preserve this wonderful corner of the earth. And so I think there's a little bit more direct ways to actually get up there. But for me, it was like, look, I want to do this in to honor Billy Frank Jr., a wonderful wildlife activist and native rights activist who helped restore treaty fishing rights to native people in Washington state and then actually across the country. And so that was the choice there. And then I learned later that there's a ton of ancient footpaths that the Nisqually people have created over literally thousands and thousands of years, that when settlers came through, we would basically start expanding that so that a horse can run along it and then eventually an automobile, and then we pave it. And so a lot of the highways and little routes we have now are actually old footpaths going back thousands of years. And so I inadvertently followed those footpaths all the way up to the final parking lot, then onto the ice. And hearing that from tribal elders as we've had a chance to connect in the aftermath, really special. Just realizing, wow, that is hallowed ground. I got to have share a small part of it during this big adventure.
Wow, that's really incredible. On the mountain itself, did you take the standard route up to the summit? And like, what were the mountain conditions, the upper mountain conditions like?
Yes, I did. So I followed the Disappointment Cleaver route via Camp Muir and then Ingram Flats. And so, yeah, it's typically the safest in my experience with the cleanest ice late season. This was, I think, August 7th is when I was up on the mountain. So ideal conditions, very few people, actually, which was a big surprise. So I only bumped into maybe a dozen climbers, including two at the top. And really special to have the mountain to yourself during a deal like this. But yeah, fantastic conditions. So good that I wore my Brooks Calderas with crampons up high. So like, I'm not even in hard boots. These are literally trail runners. And it worked great. My feet were plenty warm. I felt plenty supported. The crampons had good grip. And I've been up high on the mountain many times. This was literally the best I've ever seen the mountain. And to be able to start at the sea and then finish on the summit was a special one.
Yeah, I was kind of curious when I saw that you did it in August, because I know a lot of times the glaciers can be pretty broken up by that time and you're wandering. I mean, I did it on July 11th when I climbed Rainier, and the route was just really bad and we were wandering all around to circumvent the bigger crevasses and stuff.
Yeah, we had a couple big ribs that have formed, which would be impassable without ladder. So yeah, there were two ladder crossings, one of which was a little sketchy because the crevasse had melted out since they first put it in.
Right.
So I'm kind of shaking, like, oh, I really don't want to fall in that. I'm by myself. You know, you never want to fall in a crevasse, but particularly when you're unroped and you're with no one. So luckily, it held firm, and the ice itself was in great shape given all that.
Running on roads for how many miles to get to Paradise?
A lot. Yeah, it was a 75, I want to say, to Paris.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you run on roads for 75 miles and then you transition to going straight up the snowfield, up the mountain. I feel like my body would just be like, no, we're not doing this. Like, how was that? Like, I mean, were you just like so mentally prepared for it that it was no big deal? Or was your body just kind of like, wait, what are you asking me to do now?
Yeah. So part of the fun of when you're doing like the first of its kind is like the clock really doesn't matter too much. And so
right.
I had the energy just like, let me start keep powering through this. I got to Paradise, I want to say like 2 a.m. or so, 2:30 a.m. And so if I'm sweating the clock, I just go, I keep rolling. I wanted to have max energy for this. And so I ended up getting probably 5 hours of sleep, the parking lot there, before continuing up higher. And that was a nice refresh where like I very sharp again, had my energy back. And I just come off the run across America. So I'm used to basically a 4, 5, 6 hour sleep. And then you get up and it's Groundhog Day. And so this was a fun kind of treat of a Groundhog Day where it's like big effort ahead. This ruck's a little heavy. I've got all the water I'm going to need and we're going to roll. So yeah, mentally it was, we're going to switch gears. I love long days in the mountains. And so particularly after 75 miles of pavement, the ice is just a really nice contrast. And I love the crunch. I love, in August, there's all these like little butterflies and things like all around you. It's something like a storybook. And that's how I felt. It was such a gift of a day. And one of those moments where I was like, hey, if this is the last time I can ever be in the mountains, like what a wonderful way to go out. It was a little how I was feeling about it.
When I was researching this, I saw you've just done a huge variety of FKTs. I think you've got over 40 on the site. So what appeals to you about FKTs? What drives you to do them? How you choose the routes you're going to do? I'm curious about that process.
Yeah. So I spent my 20s in Shanghai. So I was living in China. I'm a nonprofit entrepreneur executive. So I love building models to help people. And part of that work is there's a lot of travel. And so I bring my running shoes everywhere. I would go run and swim wherever I go and always have a good time with that. I learned about the FKT community at the very beginning of 2019. I ran 7 marathons in 7 days on 7 continents with Mike Wardian. And Mike, for anyone that knows him, what a special guy, just really, really good dude. And I love how he's always challenging himself and lifting up others while doing it. And as he was describing the ethos of FKT, I was like, man, that sounds so you, Mike, and something that I would love to try. And so in the course of my travels for work in 2019, hey, I'm already going to be in Kuala Lumpur or Singapore. Let's go try one. And as I mentioned on the outset, a lot of these places weren't yet in the FKT network. And so I was like, hey, Mike, what do I do? And he's like, oh, you can set one, man. And I was like, oh, sweet. Let's go set the Singapore fastest known time from the airport to the iconic downtown Marina Bay Sands. And so I got hooked pretty quick, especially because there's an incredible community behind FKT. And I've loved when I'm going out for one of these old records. There was one a couple of years back where I'm flying to Grenada for a little Thanksgiving holiday. And had never been to Grenada, don't know anything about it. Ah, there's an FKT already set here. And there's a fellow British Canadian named Richard who set this a bunch of years ago. I reach out to Richard. We have a fantastic chat where he's giving me field notes on how to best prep for this and how to best approach it and navigate it. And here's really cool shopkeepers you should meet. Here's an Airbnb that you might enjoy staying with. And by the end of that hour-long conversation, it was just so crystallized. Man, what a special community. What a great group of people this really is. And so for me, it's about the adventure. It's about the connection. It's about the personal challenge. I also love seeing what I can do. And it's fun when you surprise yourself with, wow, I think I can get around Grenada in 13 hours, but we did it. Sweet. And those moments, they're fun, you know, while you're pushing through. Fun to kind of brag to your buddies about. And someday I want to tell, you know, my grandkids about these adventures I was able to do when I was young and dumb. And while I can, I'm going to keep doing it. So,
yeah, I definitely have really appreciated the FKT community as well. It's amazing to me how often you hear the same story of the person who's FKT you're attempting to break ends up either crewing you or supporting you or just giving you advice and helping you out. And I just love that about the FKT community. Everyone is just super supportive because it's, in the end, it's not about competing against each other. It's all about just like finding out what's possible.
Heck yeah.
And, you know, facilitating that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really enjoyed chatting with you about these, and I'm definitely looking forward to following along with your summer projects.
Hey, Heather, it is so good. I love the way you're helping build a community here. And yeah, you've got lots of fans all across the country, including here in Seattle, too.
Thanks again, Greg, for coming on the show. You can check out all his FKTs on fastestknowntime.com and follow his adventures at Greg Runs Far on Instagram.